Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for August 15th, 2008. I'm Robert Tredrick. This week, using the body's immune system to fight cancer, accounting for aerosols and climate modeling, and questioning the age of images considered to be the world's oldest art. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
For decades, researchers have been trying to target cancer by activating the immune system to attack specific tumor cells. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, a research team has found that a T-cell engaging antibody appears to have therapeutic potential for the treatment of these malignant diseases. Science News writer Fayana Richards has more.
The T-cell engaging antibody is called blinatumomab, a type of bispecific T-cell engager, or what researchers call BiTE antibodies. Researchers report that 11 out of 38 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma patients treated with doses of BiTE antibodies experienced partial and complete tumor regression, with 7 out of 7 experiencing regression at the largest dose. The treatment eliminated target cells in the blood and cleared tumor cells from the bone marrow and liver. Patrick Bowerly is corresponding author of the paper.
You want to make the BiTE antibodies bind to other structures on other cancers, and take this novel therapeutic principle and really expand that to other malignant diseases.
Here's how it works. The BiTE antibodies bind to the cancer cell and flag tumor tissue for T cells. Once T cells are attracted and become activated, their toxins attack the tumor lesion and destroy it. Rockefeller University immunologist Jeffrey Ravitch says the treatment uses a fundamental mechanism to fight tumor cells.
It's being used to harness a natural property of T cells to be cytotoxic, which means to kill other cell types. And cytotoxicity is a fundamental mechanism by which tumor cells are eradicated from the body.
And those T cells are extremely potent.
It's very impressive. It probably tells us once again that it just takes a small amount of T cell activation to have an amplified clinical response. That's always good for patients.
None of the 7 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma patients who received the largest dose and showed partial or complete tumor regression has suffered a relapse. But not all of the 38 patients in the initial trial were helped by the treatment. And some patients dropped out because of various side effects. University of Pennsylvania oncologist Carl June says those side effects were mild compared to what occurs in other forms of cancer treatments, and that they went away once treatment stopped.
So in general, with antibodies that activate the immune system like this, the side effects that you get, initially they're worse on the first dose. And generally people feel like they have the flu and it goes away. The ones they found here were trivial compared to other kinds of chemotherapy and radiation. And the real advantage of this, I think, is that this is acting in a way as a vaccine.
The success of the BiTE antibody blinatumomab has made researchers hopeful that it might someday be used as a single-agent therapy in advanced disease patients, as an alternative to the traditional chemotherapy and radiation treatments. While researchers worry that combining therapies may do more harm than good, Anthony Tolcher says that using the BiTE therapy in a sequential fashion, after traditional therapies, shouldn't be ruled out. Tolcher is an oncologist from South Texas Accelerated Research Therapeutics.
We may need to develop therapies that are given sequential, not necessarily together. Yes, in an ideal world, we could mix all our studies together and cure patients. But if they can't be combined safely or they can't be given together because one antagonizes the other, sequential use may be perfectly appropriate.
Corresponding author Patrick Bowerly expects to have new data later this year, but he says future studies are needed to understand the long-term effects of T-cell engaging antibodies. For the Science Podcast, I'm Fayana Richards.
You can read about this potential new treatment on tumor cell regression using T-cell engaging antibodies in this week's Science.
This is Nancy Goff, editor of Science Signaling. We are now accepting original research submissions for publication starting September 2008. The journal formerly known as Science's SDKE is devoted to the topic of cellular signal transduction. To learn more, go to www.sciencesignaling.org.
The behavior of clouds and aerosols are the biggest question marks in developing climate models that accurately assess and predict climate change. But a paper in this week's Science describes how aerosols affect cloud formation over the Amazon rainforest, a first step in figuring out the global effects of aerosols. Science News writer Andrea Liu has more.
Most of the aerosols in the atmosphere come from volcanoes and other natural events, such as sea spray and dust storms. Human activities, notably the burning of fossil fuels, accounts for about 10% of the total. And the big question for scientists is whether aerosols warm or cool the atmosphere. Kathy Cahill studies aerosols at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
It's the biggest uncertainty in climate models right now. And everybody's trying desperately to say, okay, how much of this warming we're seeing is due to human influence? How much of it is natural? Well, it's really hard to answer that question unless you know all the different things that contribute to a warming or cooling. And aerosols are one of those things that we don't know that well.
Ilan Koren is an environmental scientist at the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel. He explains how aerosols help form clouds.
Basically, aerosol serves as cloud condensation nuclei for clouds. And clouds need aerosols in order for the drops to form.
So the more aerosols in the atmosphere, the more seeds the water vapor can condense around. Condensation creates clouds, which reflect the sun's radiation back into space and lower the temperature of the atmosphere. On the other hand, the black carbon particles in smoke absorbs energy from the sun, which warms the atmosphere. An elevated temperature can prevent clouds from forming. In turn, fewer clouds mean more sunlight passes through the atmosphere, warming the Earth further.
So here you have a kind of a competition between two different physics, different type of physics, different effects.
In a paper published in this week's Science, Corinne and colleagues at the Weizmann Institute and the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland developed a model that accounts for both warming and cooling effects by incorporating both mechanisms.
Until now, we focused on either one of them because it's so complicated. And here we dare to look on the two effects at the same time together, and we show very complicated effects.
Part of the complication are the many factors that determine whether clouds form. In addition to particles, clouds need what scientists call an unstable temperature profile, in which turbulent mixing happens of warmer or cooler air. In the researchers' model, when aerosols absorb solar energy, that can stabilize the temperature profile and thus reduce the number of clouds forming. And the fewer the clouds that exist, the more solar radiation is picked up by aerosols. Eventually, the temperature rises sufficiently and again becomes unstable, which promotes new cloud formation, which cools the Earth. Corinne says the initial number of clouds help determine whether there will be more and more clouds or fewer and fewer.
We are showing that if one wants to estimate correctly the absorption effect, he must consider the initial cloud fraction as a major component of the equation.
Paula Artasho says that absorption effect is also driven by the concentration of aerosols. Artasho is an environmental physicist at the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil.
So depending on how aerosol concentration will change in the future, we could have a much warmer climate than we have today due to the increase in the greenhouse gases.
The big problem, however, is that aerosol levels are extremely difficult to monitor. Unlike greenhouse gases, which are fairly uniform around the globe and can remain in the atmosphere for hundreds of years, aerosols may last only for weeks and vary by region.
If you extend our scientific vision of how anthropogenic phenomena are changing the climate, we can do a much, much more comprehensive and a much more complete science like this paper shows very clearly. He had stupendous and very spectacular results that are very critical for the global climate modeling of our planet.
Corinne's model relies on figures from smoke rising over the Amazon basin. That means researchers like Kathy Cahill from the University of Alaska in Fairbanks would need a modified version of the model in order to accommodate the dust and pollution and other types of aerosols she studies in the Arctic.
So I see them taking the model and extending it beyond the Amazon, using it in different places to really try to tease out what's going on and to try to predict. And if they get to a point where they're comfortable that it's predicting things quite well, then they can say, okay, we understand the basic physics. Now we just need the refinements to perfect it.
Of course, a model is only as good as the data going into it. So scientists will need to know more about how the amount of aerosols is changing over space and time. But with an increasing amount and quality of data coming from monitoring systems, including satellites, researchers hope to start clearing the haze to see what's really going on with the climate. For the Science Podcast, I'm Andrea Liu.
You can read Karen and colleagues' paper about the model they developed in this week's Science. Also this week in Science, negative refraction. If water had the property of negative refraction, then a fish swimming in a stream would appear to be above the stream. Previous research had yielded negative refraction materials in two-dimensional systems, but in Abrevia, Jie Yao and colleagues describe a new three-dimensional metamaterial made from silver nanowires embedded in a porous alumina template, with separation distances between the nanowires much smaller than the wavelength of optical frequencies. The team says the research may prompt new applications in waveguiding, imaging, and optical communication. Read the paper and a related news article in this week's Science. It's been 14 years since the discovery of cave drawings at La Grotte-Chavée. Widely considered the world's oldest cave art, the drawings have been radiocarbon dated to about 32,000 years old. But now, questions are resurfacing about the age of the drawings, and that's casting doubt on the cognitive and symbolic abilities of the modern humans who first colonized Europe some 40,000 years ago. From France, Science's contributing correspondent Michael Balter writes about it in this week's issue.
This year marks the 10-year anniversary of when researchers first started working in the Chauvet Cave, which is down in the Ardèche region of France, the south-central region of France. And there are some very famous cave paintings, especially particularly one of four horses' heads that's quite magnificent, that gets reproduced a lot. And it's widely heralded as the world's oldest cave art. It's been radiocarbon dated to the time window of between 30 and 32,000 years ago. And most of what's been found has been published in, you know, kind of French journals, specialty journals. The team has published a few very elaborate coffee table books with a decent amount of text. But I think that the details of what's gone on at the Chauvet Cave over the last 10 years are not so well known. And that's what we tried to convey in our story.
What have researchers been hoping to learn along the way with all of this various analysis of these cave paintings?
Well, of course, the holy grail of cave art studies would be to figure out exactly what was in the artist's mind when he or she executed the drawings and what those manifestations, what those drawings and other artworks represented symbolically to the artist. It bears on the question of what the cognitive and symbolic abilities were of the modern humans who first colonized Europe around 40,000 years ago. Because the conventional idea was that there was a sort of a linear development, that modern humans, Homo sapiens, didn't just arrive in Europe with the ability to do this kind of spectacular art, but it was something that had to develop over a long period of time, both cognitively, culturally, and so forth. The surprise at Chauvet was that it overturned that idea. And the more that we can find out about the environment in the cave, as well as settlement patterns of prehistoric people outside of a cave like this, the more glimpses we'll have into that. But, you know, we're never really going to know what it is that we want to know, which in archaeology is pretty much par for the course.
Now, the site's age has been well documented as about 30 to 32,000 years old, hasn't it?
Well, yes and no. That's a big part of our story.
That makes it pretty difficult to decide which culture it was that drew these paintings.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, that's really the crux of the matter. One thing I should point out, by the way, is that when we say that the cave is 32,000 years old through radiocarbon dating, there's no agreed radiocarbon calibration curve beyond 26,000 years at the moment. They're working on it. And so when we say 32,000 years ago, we're talking radiocarbon years, which could be as much as 5,000 years earlier, actually. So Chauvet could really be dated, the art in Chauvet could really be dated to 37,000 years in actual calendar years. Now, you're absolutely right that knowing the date is absolutely critical to interpreting what the art might mean. because the date of 32,000 years ago is in a cultural period called the Aurignacian, which pretty much corresponds to the first cultural manifestations of modern humans when they first came and colonized Europe about 40,000 years ago. But that dating was a big surprise to a lot of archaeologists because the paintings are so elaborate and sophisticated that nothing like them had really been seen before any earlier than another period called the Magdalenian, which ranges from about 17,000 to 12,000 years ago. Now, when you run into this kind of situation, a contradiction between the style of the art and the sophistication of the art and the dating from paintings on the wall, you kind of have two choices. You can either believe the dating or you can believe the stylistic conventions, which clearly, at least at the beginning, did seem to contradict each other.
What's some of the evidence, then, that somebody didn't just pick up some old charcoal from the cave floor and draw on the walls at some point later?
Well, I think there's basically three lines of evidence. It, by the way, is possible, and I think that everybody that I spoke to, other than perhaps some members of the Chauvet team who are just really having none of it, but most of the outside observers and outside experts I talked to thought that it was possible that the dating could be wrong. But there's kind of a confluence of basically three types of evidence. You've got the dating of the art on the walls from a very skilled and experienced lab here in France that dates cave art and has done this kind of dating before. It's not easy to do and requires very small samples, but it is done and has been done. You've got the charcoal on the ground, which it really does appear to have a fairly close association with the paintings. It's really, you know, kind of below. You'll have a drawing of an animal and you'll have a bunch of charcoal right underneath it. And then the third line of evidence is radiocarbon dating of the ubiquitous cave bear bones, which also the best dates on them, the dates from the bear bones that are the best preserved, also range in at around 30 to 32,000 years ago. And we also know that the cave, probably from geological evidence and from dating of stalagmites around the caved-in original entrance of the cave, we know that no bear or human was likely to have gone to the cave after about 19,000 years ago, which is before the Magdalenian. So those three lines of evidence have convinced most, but not all archaeologists, that the dating is sound.
What, if anything, would settle the debate over the age of these cave paintings for these people who remain unconvinced?
Well, the skeptics have asked for more things to be done. One of the things, I think the most important thing that they have asked to be done, is that the direct dating on the walls of the paints of the drawings be replicated by other laboratories other than this French laboratory that I mentioned a minute ago. And as a matter of fact, that was done for the charcoal on the ground, and that all came out consistently at 30,000 years or older. The problem is that they have taken, or did originally take, all of the samples that they could from the cave art without kind of messing up the drawings. In other words, they took samples from those that they could without changing any of the lines, just sort of changing the thickness maybe of some of the line drawings. And those who have raised these issues do say that they would be satisfied if there was additional replication directly from the cave wall. But doesn't look at the moment like that's likely to happen. So we're kind of stuck with the debate at the moment without an immediate solution to it. But there's another trend of thought, too, and I think this was expressed to me. We end the story with this thought. Meg Conkey at the University of California at Berkeley said that the most important thing is not really how old the art is or whether this is the origins of art or the oldest art. The most important thing about Chauvet is what we can learn about what it was about their lives and their life ways, is the way she put it, that made people who were living around a cave like Chauvet or who were living in France at that time want to make art, that we may never know what it means, but why do they want to make it? And that's the most important thing that we should be trying to figure out.
Michael Balter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Science contributing correspondent Michael Balter on the paintings at Le Grand Chauvet. Read his article in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science stories. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to talk about whether running shoes are the fountain of youth, how water striders stay afloat, and finally, the genetics of body odor.
All right, well, let's start with running shoes as the fountain of youth. Something about the health benefits of running?
Well, Rob, we all know that running is a good exercise in terms of maintaining health. But when the running craze started in the 1970s in the United States and elsewhere, some doctors were concerned that older people that started running were doing damage to their body, namely damage to their joints and perhaps giving themselves other types of injuries that they wouldn't get if they weren't running. But a scientist at Stanford University felt the opposite. He felt that no matter what age you started running, and especially if you started running older, the pros far outweighed the cons. So what he did was he and some of his colleagues started way back in 1984 tracking over 500 runners over the age of 50. And they've been following them for over 20 years now. And every year they would give them a questionnaire about how well they were performing in life, you know, how what their ease of certain life tasks were, like even things like doing the laundry and putting on clothes. And also monitoring their health. What kind of health were they in? What kind of diseases were they getting? Were they dying? Things like that.
With the idea of comparing them against some control group.
Right. They compared them against a control group of non-runners.
Who presumably were also healthy, just not running.
Right. Well, the concern with a study like this is always cause and effect. Do people start running because they're healthier to begin with, and therefore you might misconclude that runners just tend to be healthier, or are people healthier because they run? And so to try to control for that, the researchers looked at a control group of people that were generally in the same type of shape as the runners were, they just weren't runners. And what they found was, first of all, not very surprising that the runners tended to be in better shape than the non-runners. But what was surprising was the amount of difference they saw in the types of diseases and mortality among the runners compared to the non-runners. For instance, 19 years into the study, 34% of the non-running group had died compared to only 15% of the running group. And what's more, only about 7% of the runners had infections and neurological diseases and diseases like cancer, whereas 19% of the non-runners had those sorts of problems.
And that difference is statistically significant?
That difference is statistically significant. And what was also a really neat finding is the researchers found that even people who only ran regularly for about a month during their lives, so they took up running, they did it for a little while, but then they gave it up, even they showed some benefits of running. Now, the benefits weren't as great as the people that were running full-time, but even just a little bit of running seems to have a positive effect on long-term health.
Have researchers figured out what it is exactly about running that's actually helping people live longer?
No, it's a really interesting question. And obviously, that's the next step in the study to figure out. Now that we know that running does have these dramatic effects on health, the question is, how is it doing it?
Well, from running for your health to walking on water, what's new about water striders? These are the little bugs that skitter around on the tops of lakes and other calm water surfaces.
Right, exactly. These are these neat little insects that skim across the top of water. And scientists have been trying to figure out for a long time, how do these guys stay above the water? Why don't they sink? And they know it has something to do with a property called surface tension. The more you can sort of disperse your mass over a larger area, the less you're likely to sink in the water because you're distributing that mass and it's not putting as much sort of strain on the top of the water. But the water striders have these very specific length of legs. And researchers are wondering, what is it about that length? Is there a magic number for how long those legs are that is just precisely optimized for keeping these guys on top of the water? And so they did a bunch of mathematical calculations. And what they ended up with was sort of comparing the water strider's legs to a pool noodle.
These are the little floaty.
Right. These are these like long styrofoam kind of bars that kids hang on to in the pools and sometimes adults hang on to too and just help them stay afloat. And so if you think of a water strider's leg as a pool noodle, you can imagine that the longer the noodle gets or the longer the leg gets, you start to get some bending when it comes in contact with the water. And the shorter the leg is or the shorter the noodle is, the stiffer it is. And what the researchers found was that if the noodle or the leg is too short, it's going to break the surface tension of the water because too much mass is being concentrated in too small of an area. But if the noodle is too long, it starts to bend or the leg starts to bend and it creates too much drag on the water. And that causes the insect difficulty staying afloat. So when they looked at the legs of this insect, they found that the length of the leg was almost exactly the maximum length it would need to be to maximally support the insect without causing drag. So it seems that over the millions of years that these insects have been evolving, these legs have grown to this optimal length to keep them on top of the water without having too much drag and without making them sink.
The selective pressure is sort of driving that optimization then.
Exactly.
How are researchers hoping to apply this knowledge?
Well, it's kind of a neat finding just to figure out something like this. But, you know, researchers are developing robots and other things that can skim the surface of water. So the more they can learn about how it happens in nature, the more they can apply it to future technology.
Well, from the physics of surface tension to the genetics of body odor, I really would have thought this would have been more about the chemistry of sweat.
Well, it kind of is. If you think about body odor comes from a combination of two things, the sweat that we excrete out our pores and also the bacteria that live in places like our armpits. And this sweat that we excrete has at least 24 types of a compound known as carboxylic acid. And these acids somehow react with the bacteria and create the stink that you might have after a workout. But it's not just these bad smells we are concerned about when we talk about body odor. We're also talking about potential impact on mate choice. Researchers have shown that body odor in mice helps males and females select the appropriate mate. And there's been some evidence in humans that a similar process takes place. So
the genetics is affecting the chemistry.
Well, the idea is the genetics is affecting the chemistry because you have different people who have different body odors. So there must be a genetic component, but how do you go about measuring it? Well, in this study, researchers used a classic system, and that was to go to identical twins. And genetic twins share all the same DNA, so their genetics is pretty much the same. And they wanted to see, do genetic twins manufacture the same kind of body odor chemicals because they have the same genes? And they recruited, for this study, they recruited 12 pairs of identical twins, 7 sets of sisters, and 5 sets of brothers. And they put cotton pads under their armpits and had them exercise for about an hour. And then after that, they took the pads and they did some chemical analysis to figure out exactly which types of carboxylic acids were being produced by which people. And lo and behold, as they expected, the carboxylic acids produced by each twin was very similar to that of the other twin. And when they compared the twins to other people, they noticed very different carboxylic acid patterns. So this is really the strongest evidence yet that these odors that we produce are genetically determined. Our genes determine how we smell.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
Well, Rob, we're looking into a story about a hidden cholera epidemic, about a spooky speed limit. And this is the speed limit that governs how photons communicate with each other over large distances. And it has to do with some bizarre properties of quantum mechanics. And finally, we're looking into a story about how contraceptive pills may change how attracted some women are to men. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site of science. You can catch up on the latest science news at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the August 15th, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.